Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the After Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
That's me. My name is Justin.
Brian Brushwood.
Justin thinks he's the only one that can sing his intro response.
And joining us is the much more eloquently spelled Brian. We have here Brian Thomas Schmidt, who is actually part of the Humble Bundle, of which I'm very fortunate to consider myself included in. In which you can get some amazing books, actually 22 books, with ranging including 4 unpublished Frank Herbert novels. And there are several anthologies of short stories there, including Decision Points, which was, I believe, edited by you, Brian?
Yes, it was. I have to sing
it. Oh, he did it! It worked! I told you one of these days it was going to work.
Knockout. Knockout performance.
I do that, so, you know, I can do that.
Yeah, right on.
So, Brian, you're a science fiction writer. You're an editor. And well, I mean, what's involved in editing an anthology, by the way?
Well,
probably knowing how to pronounce it as anthology, not anthology, as I like to say.
Yes, because there is no second A.
Yeah, I think I went to high school with an anthology.
But no, I pick the theme. I sell it to a publisher. And I invite all the authors, and I pick the stories and help them polish them up if they need it, and then pick the order, write the intro to the book as well as any stories, assemble the manuscripts, bios, all that stuff, and that's pretty much how you put together an anthology. I've done it. I've got, you know, my 12th anthology in the works right now, so I've done quite a few. This is going to be only the number 6 that comes out. But I've got a whole bunch more that'll be showing up here in the next few, next 18 months.
Something that is very interesting to me is how you, as the editor of an anthology, select the topic. Because obviously, you know, Decision Points, that's a great, big, broad area where a lot of talented people can write a bunch of talented stories. Whereas, like, making a ham sandwich would probably be more limited. What goes into that kind of thinking?
Well, actually, the original title was Choices, but the publisher didn't like that, and so I needed something else. And I figured, well, Decision Points is a little bit more dynamic, and it's kind of really the same thing. Basically, yeah. The idea was to have stories where the character's choice is partially responsible or fully responsible for the outcome of the story. So I picked that kind of thing. It actually was handed to me by my friend and somebody I've co-edited with, Jennifer Brozak. And it's because I wanted something a little bit more general and generic that I could get multiple genres involved with. Some things like space battles is obviously more specific. That's only science fiction. But this is science fiction, fantasy, and horror. So we can have darker and lighter stuff both mixed in here. And that was part of the goal. The other thing is, so you come up with a theme. You want something broad enough that people can interpret it in diverse ways, so you don't get all the same story, but something focused enough that people know what they're getting, kind of.
Yeah.
You want the title to sell the book in a way. You want something that hasn't been done recently, or if you're going to do that, at least pick something that you know has been done crappy recently. So you can brag that you've done it definitively or better. Although, probably not the recommended approach. I don't think throwing crap on somebody else's work is the way to promote yourself ever.
No.
But I'm just saying. And then you know, so that's how you kind of pick your theme. And then you just kind of go from there and see how people, you know, it's YA, so I did interpret a few, you know, watch the language to a degree and the sexual content and graphic stuff to a degree that's appropriate for that, you know, the age group. But beyond that, I mean, it's pretty much I'm like, okay, what can you come up with? But in this case, it actually is 20 stories, 14 of which were reprints. and six of which are new. So I only really had new people writing to the theme in six stories. The rest of them, I went out and picked stories, and the sub-theme was to pick both YA people that are known for YA and people who have not been known for writing young adult necessarily, either because their stuff was not marketed just young adult, but it was, or because, you know, their stuff typically is just that's they've got the adult audience. They've never really gone after the YA audience. So I was picking some older stories that might have come about, like Robert Silverberg's story probably was published when there was no YA.
So as editor, I know part of the job of editors is to correct certain things or massage stuff. But since some of these were published but now they're being published specifically to young adults, were there any of those that you actually changed parts of the story in order to make it more appropriate for this audience?
Generally, I don't have to do that because once you set those parameters, the writers know what's allowed or not.
Mm-hmm.
There were definitely some stories that I worked through and had them edit. None of the reprints got anything but cleanup. You don't go back and ask somebody to re-edit their reprinted story, especially professional. That they don't want to do that.
Sure.
And that's kind of inappropriate. And besides, I can pick stories. If I think a story's not ready, I'll just pick something else. I don't need to mess with
that. Vonnegut, you're fired.
Right. I'm not paying them enough money anyway to make it worth their time to do a whole bunch of rewriting anyway. You know, reprint rates are not the same. So, I did with the newer stories, but not with the reprints. But even then, most of them, except for a couple from the newer writers, pretty much came in polished and just needed a little bit here and there. So I asked for what I wanted, and they gave it to me. The actual reprint that went through the most rewrite was actually my reprint.
Ha!
Because I had had it published years ago by a semi-pro market, but I wanted to make sure it was up to par with the rest of the stories. So I sent it to a friend of mine who's another editor and said, tear this thing apart and tell me if I can make it up to professional standards. And he did. So I did quite a bit of rewriting to polish it up. So it's actually kind of, in a way, a new version. The only other one that really had any significant change was Orson Scott Card's Ender story. He cut one of the scenes that he felt was kind of a sideline scene it didn't need. So technically, we got a story that it's a novella or novelette. It's slightly shorter than the version that was originally released by itself in a standalone book from his publisher, Tor. It's slightly different than that, so it's never really appeared in this form. But that one had never – most of these reprints had never appeared in an anthology before either. That was part of the appeal.
So I've heard now from a couple different people. Like I did a panel with Steve Altman who mentioned that his entry point into publishing was to do an anthology, was to collect a bunch of other people together, and then he gets his name associated with other names. And here you mentioned – you have an Orson Scott Card story, which you've got Orson Scott Card story now in the Humble Bundle. And that's kind of amazing kind of association to have there. And is that kind of a hack, would you say? I mean, not using hack in the pejorative term, but kind of a good way for somebody who loves literature, loves writing, and who wants to get involved in publishing to get in is to say, hey, if I can get people together to do this, then I'm in.
Well, I don't know how. I mean, it's hard to sell anthologies right now. It's really hard. The majority of publishers. It's hard to sell them to publishers. The majority of anthologies do not make their money back. I've been very lucky with mine, except for a couple early ones. All of mine have been earning back. So they're not making a huge profit, but they're earning back the advance. So that is good. So, I mean, it might be an entry point for some people. It certainly was for Steve Altman. It certainly was for me.
Mm-hmm.
But I used it more because I wanted the opportunity to help people. I wanted to work with writers who were my heroes, and I wanted to work with some up-and-coming writers and give them a chance to appear alongside their heroes and get more exposure. And at the same time, felt like I had a voice as an editor that would be worthwhile because I'd been told that I did. So all of those things came together, and then I was able to finally sell books to major publishers and have. It's a great... it then provides a great opportunity because I have existing relationships with all of these editors and publishers. I can pitch my novels and other things to them directly as opposed to going through an agent. So there is that advantage to it. But it's I still have numerous projects, including Decision Points, which take forever to sell. Decision Points has actually been around for 3 or 4 years, and I finally found a publisher for it, and it's finally coming out. So, but literally, I was shopping the thing for a long time before it ever sold.
And do you have to have all of it selected before you shop, or you shop the idea first and then collect the works?
Often, I have a couple example stories if I'm doing reprints, and then I have writers who are headlining names attached, like Steve Alton would be one, for example. I have those kind of people attached and say, these people are willing to do stories for this anthology. Here's the budget. Here's the idea. Here's my credentials. And they say yes or no, and I do the book. But in the case of Decision Points, I had pretty much, except for a couple new stories that I added because I got an extra budget boost, everything was written and assembled pretty much before I sold it. So that's why actually we didn't do the deal until like November, December, and the book's already coming out because we could move very quickly because I had the book all together. My other books, like, you know, that I've sold, like I'm working on them and they won't turn in till the end of the year and it come out a year later. So it's kind of been a faster process for this book and it's kind of a little different.
So you've got an unpublished or previously unpublished or Orson Scott Card Ender's story in there.
Yeah, it had been published by itself as a little standalone novelette book at the holiday time because it's got a holiday theme to it. Mm-hmm. And so Tor had put it out in hardback and then a little paperback version of it, 40, 50 pages, whatever, of it, because the Ender audience is obviously big enough they'll snatch up anything they could get. But it had never been appeared anywhere else. So I contacted Scott and he was like, yeah, you can publish this. I actually want to trim this one scene out because I think it's a sideline. It takes away from the story. I'll get rid of that and give it to you in that form, and then you'll have it, and it's never been published like this. A little bit shorter, and sure, that's great. So we have a never-before-anthologized Orson Scott Card story that a lot of people, if they're not core fans, have not read.
Wow. That's pretty neat to be able to make that phone call.
It was awesome because I'm a huge fan of Ender's Game.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I, you know, it's a huge inspiration on me as a writer. So I was like, holy crap. You know, like I said, I get to work with my heroes. It's kind of pretty. And over time, some of them become friends. So, I mean, Robert Silverberg's a huge influence on me. And he has a story in a lot of my anthologies, including this one. So it's just kind of mind-boggling sometimes when you think about it.
Well, we talk to a lot of authors, and you know, everybody wants to figure out like how do you get into the business, and it's hard, you know, to come up with an answer because the business is changing so much so quickly. What advice do you give to somebody who says, "Hey, I want to be an SF author. I want to do this." What do you tell them?
If you don't absolutely love it and have to do it, go find something easier. You know, that sounds terrible, but the truth is, look, this is really hard. It's really hard. Look, I've sold all these anthologies, and lately I've sold a bunch of them to major publishers. And those were pretty hard to sell, and I got very, very lucky. And then I have long periods where I sell nothing. Like right now, I've got like 3 books to finish up, and I have nothing like sold. So I'm starting – for a while, I had 5 or 6 of them all lined up, you know. And there may be a period where I have a drought where I don't sell anything and I have to sit for a while. And you have to be able to survive that. I have long periods between when I sell a story or you know, I still haven't sold a novel to a major publisher. So I've worked on very small advances for the stuff I've sold. So, I mean, it's a tough business. But if you really love it and you can find your unique voice and you're willing to work hard, it's worth doing. But understand that the majority of people are not going to get rich and famous, and they're not going to have it as their sole source of income. You know, there's only a lucky few. And if you want to squeeze by like me on $18,000 a year on the edge of poverty, you can do it. But it took me years to even get up to that level where I could do that as my job.
Wild.
Well, that's motivational.
Well, it's sobering. I mean, I realize it's not
the
kind of
dream.
Like, no, exactly. It's not like, yay, but you know what? I kind of operate under the philosophy that when people ask me for advice, since I'm an editor anyway, I'm kind of supposed to tell you the truth and not necessarily what you want to hear. And I'd love to help but you know, I'm not doing you a service by lying to you.
Well,
I just want to say, I totally agree. And I think that when you're passionate and you love to write, that is the thing you do, and you just find a way to make that happen. Everything else is irrelevant.
Well, exactly. I mean, look, some people are going to get it on. Look, I mean, I edited by luck. I got to edit The Martian by Andy Weir, for example, which everybody knows it's a huge hit. And he hit the author lottery, right? Well, I'm sitting here thinking, well, I've been writing longer than Andy Weir. Why can't I hit the author lottery, right? And I can sit there and I can be jealous about that, or I can say it happens to some people, and Andy's a very nice guy, and it's a very good book, and I'm very proud to have been a small part of it, and I'm not putting him down at all. He hit the author lottery, but I haven't, and I may never hit the author lottery. And so, but I do have people who like and follow and read my work and wait for it to come out and really look forward to spending money on it. So I'm very lucky. I have to appreciate that. Do I hope someday to make a little bit more money at it than I do now? Yes, but you kind of have to be willing to accept that if you have a voice and people are reading it, then take whatever comes with that.
Then you want,
some people are going to get wealthy with it and some are not.
As a matter of fact, it reminds me, when I was 19 years old, I got to have lunch with the teller from Penn & Teller, and I asked him, like, when did you feel success? When did you know you'd made it? And he took a moment to reflect on it, and he says, to be honest, the moment I was able to pay my bills and do what I loved, everything else since then has just been a matter of degrees. That was the moment he felt successful, was when it's like, hey, you won the lottery. You get to be an artist and do something you love, something that's in you that needs to come out, now pays your bills.
See, and I would feel successful if I ever got Teller to talk to me.
We could probably at least figure out an email. You know, there can be a CC situation in your future.
It's all perspective. That's all I'm saying.
If I may be allowed to do a humble brag, this week I got nominated by the International Thriller Writers for my book, Name of the Devil, is now up as a finalist for Best Original Paperback of the Year.
Congrats.
And
congrats.
Wow.
It's exciting. It's cool. It is absolutely wonderful. But it's that imposter syndrome. You look at this and you're like, well, I see how everything's held together with duct tape and chewing gum and all that. And it's very flattering, but you're like, yeah, but if only they knew, if only they knew.
Well, and you know, it's that curse of knowing, right? It's like, you know that you won this award because you bothered to ask these people to apply and blah blah blah, and you're like, well, therefore it doesn't really count or whatever. I'm saying, like, in general, not this specific instance, but like, you know, for example, the podcast awards. You know, it's like, oh, we won best mature video podcast, you know, last year on the podcast awards, but you know, we asked them and they worked really hard and it was just fans. It's like, that in no way invalidates, there's the beautiful trophy right there, the fact that the only thing that changed is that we know how we got to that point. It doesn't not mean it's an accomplishment.
Actually, there was no campaigning for this. Was totally, I had no idea that I was even up for it. It was a thing that was submitted with many, many other books to a committee. There's not a thing where it's left that at all. It was a strange thing, because it's in horror you have the Stoker, in mystery you have the Edgar, in sci-fi you'd have like Sadie Hugo or the Nebula, and for thriller it's a very different sort of thing, because it's not like, you know, when I push for people to like, hey, if you like my book, support on Amazon, that's one thing. But this was industry recognition, which totally came from a different point of view, which is sort of, that was what made it weird, was.
And I get that. They're just trying to keep you humble. No,
and this is number one. I mean, I think we shouldn't run over the fact that this is a tremendous honor and a culmination of many, many, many years of hard work to get to a point where an industry award that recognizes a critical element, as well as, you know, even to be nominated, is a coronation of Andrew, of a name to watch in that field, is a huge achievement, and I'm very, very, very proud of Andrew. You know, that happened, and Name of the Devil is certainly a worthy book for praise.
Andrew,
aren't you on the list with David Morrell, of all people? Is it David Morrell on that list too? David Morrell,
I got it. Yeah. And one of our fellow WordFire authors, Jean Raven, she's on there too.
Yes,
she's,
I know Jean was on there, and Jean's certainly a workman who's been around for a long time. But I was like, you know, David Morrell is a huge name, and he was nominated for one of those awards, if not this one. I mean, some of those guys that you're up against, it's like, you know, you're known for whatever you're known for. Maybe you're more known for magic and being on TV than you are as an author at this point. And people were like, oh, what's he doing there? I mean, that imposter thing, I think, is a natural thing. And I think it's a healthy thing. because, you know, it helps keep you humble. It also helps you keep making good art. You don't want to get carried away and say, oh, I don't need an editor anymore, or I don't need this anymore, or, you know, whatever. My dog could write the book. I'd have slapped my name on it. I don't get, you know. It's healthy. It's healthy to say, you know what? I still got a lot to figure out. I don't know how I did it. So congrats and good luck. I mean, that's all I'm really
thank
saying.
You.
Yeah,
thank
when,
you. Yeah,
when will you find out about that?
They have a ceremony in July at the Thriller Fest.
So
in, convention.
Are you going to be
New York City?
Are you going to be there?
I have no idea. Mm. I have no idea.
Are you gonna dress up? Are you gonna like?
He doesn't know if he's gonna be there. How does he know if he's gonna dress up? He'll dress up at home and watch.
He can dress up anywhere, man. Like there ain't no laws against it.
Yeah,
his best bathrobe and slippers on, and he's sitting at home watching it on the internet. There you go.
Doesn't matter. I watched myself win an award from the internet when Brian when he won that podcast award. He was up there being a real kook and
gentleman, real gentleman up there.
Yeah,
accepting that award.
So, Brian with a Y, what was the book, what was the thing that you read that made you decide this is what you wanted to spend your life doing?
Well, there's more than one, but Robert Silverberg's Lord Valentine's Castle is the one I always bring up and remember. Because the world building in that book was so fantastic. I always talk about how, you know, my sister gave it to me at Christmas. It wasn't what I asked for. I'd never heard of Robert Silverberg at the time because I wasn't really tuned in. I was like, why'd you buy me this? Whatever. She's like, well, the bookstore said it was really great. It sounded like your kind of thing. And I'm like, okay, well, the only reason you're getting away with this is because there's a woman with three breasts on the front cover. Okay, that's all I'm saying. But no, I love the book so much that, like, I was, like, in my room. You know, I think my parents thought I was in my room for other reasons that teenagers stay in their room. But I was in my room reading this book for a long time because I couldn't put it down. And the world building is so fantastic in that book and so big and so detailed that I was just amazed that he could write, you know, this much. It was kind of, I mean, I'd read The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit somewhere around the same time, so I saw that too. But this was kind of the first time I really read anything truly epic. It just really stuck in my mind as, wow, there's a guy with a lot of ideas. I have a lot of ideas, but I'd love to do that someday.
What was your path to where you are now? How did you get more involved in doing this?
Jeez, that's a long story.
we got time.
So, you know, I started out wanting to do TV and film more than wanting to write books. And so I went to film school out in L.A. and I spent some time in development hell with screenplays. And I worked on TV shows like for History Channel, like Biography is the most famous show I worked on. But we worked on a couple Emmy award-winning specials, and we worked on different things. We did the Raymond Burr special with Bill Cosby when Raymond Burr passed away that NBC did, things like that. And I worked on a lot of that stuff and finally decided that, you know, I wasn't going to be a big screenwriter. It wasn't happening for whatever reason. And they kept telling me I needed to live more and write less stereotypical stuff. So I went out and became a musician and traveled the world and went back to school, got a master's degree, and did a bunch of stuff, and ended up traveling to Africa and Brazil and Mexico and all these places, basically getting a life, and came back with stories and sat down a few years later and started to write them and wrote a horrible first novel. And it wasn't science fiction at all. It was something else, and it was horrible. I still love that story, but I just couldn't execute it worth a damn. So I spent a year studying craft and then came back to an idea I'd had when I was 15 of kind of the Moses meets Star Wars story that I wrote as the Saga of Dobby Ree. And that got published. WordFire's got a brand new edition of it out. It's called The Worker Prince. And the Returning will be out in August, which is book two. And then I have The Exodus, which will probably be out early next year. So I wrote these novels. They had been published. Two of them had been published previously by a micropress that went out of business. So I kind of revisited them recently. Yeah, that's the old cover for the original release. I basically revisited them and decided I would rewrite them according to where my craft is now and polish them up and got WordFire to re-release them. And so here we are. And the third book has never been released. So it's going to be finally people will know how it ends. So that's how I really got into this. And then somewhere along the way, in between all that, I volunteered to edit an anthology called Space Battles, had a good time, decided that was something worth doing, kickstarted a couple of anthologies and sold one to Bane Books, and here I am.
That's right, awesome.
It's interesting. So you've done you've done the different things that people try to do, you know, as writers and go out there and set out to do, and you keep coming to the fact. I mean, I'm impressed by the fact of you. I'm a guy that loves my own stuff, and I'm too self-obsessed to get into what other people are doing, which makes me sort of bad when it comes to trying to support and endorse other things. And you have a genuine love of, you know, of sci-fi, of fantasy, of what the genre, you know, and that's admirable. That's very, very admirable that when you're not using it to advance what you're doing, you're using it to promote the other things that you want to celebrate.
Well, I mean, I think I'm surely, especially in magic, there's people that are your heroes that you kind of imitated. You wanted to learn their tricks. You wanted to do stuff as you came up. I'm sure you modeled yourself after other people. But I think you can get to a point where you're kind of you have mastered your craft, or you've gotten to a certain level where you don't do that as much anymore. And I don't think the way you describe it, it sounds kind of self-centered, but I don't know that it's necessarily a bad thing. I don't always have as much time to read as I would like. And as I used to have, I'm having to make time for it. But most of the time I'm reading short stories for anthologies or books that I'm editing, right? So I've never read the final version of The Martian. I've never had time to go back. I read the version I edited in 2013 before he sold it to Crown. But the final version I've never had a chance to go read because I just have too much going on. But, you know, I suffer kind of from somewhere in between where you are and where other people might be, but I'm always going to be a fan, that's for sure. And the being a fan drives me, and I think it drives a lot of people in science fiction and that community generally, is that we are fans first. And I love discovering a great new book or a great new story. So that, of course, makes editing more fun.
What advice do you give when, you know, to writers, when you're being somebody who sit there and read a lot of what other people are doing, aspirationals and whatnot, what are the big mistakes? What are things to avoid? And like when it comes to short stories, which is something I don't have a lot of experience in, which are, I'm basically saying, you know, tell me.
What are things to avoid? I mean, you've got to, you know, first of all, don't worry about avoiding telling a story that's already been told. Because you're never going to, all right? They've all been done in some form or another. What you want to do is tell a story in your unique way with your unique voice. You want to put your unique spin on it and your unique twist on it, and you want to do it that way, okay? If you drive yourself crazy trying to come up with the thing that nobody's ever done, it's silly because somewhere somebody can find something to say, oh, well, somebody else did a version of this story back then. Somebody can always find that. And then you're all deflated and you're all like, oh, man, I thought I came up with this. Don't worry about it. What you want to do is come up with the, you know, nobody could write this but Andrew Main. Nobody could do that. That's the first part of your answer. Now, the more specific part about short stories is, you know, I'll be honest with you. I sucked at writing short stories until I became a short story editor. Now I'm a lot better at it, but I used to, everything I had was long form because I grew up reading more novels and only reading short stories really when I had to for school and stuff. Occasionally I would read one, but mostly they didn't interest me. I wanted to long form novels. So that was how I think about story. And so I've had to learn how to do it as an editor, and it's taught me how to do it now. You have to come up with a smaller concept. You have to come up with kind of a smaller three-act arc and leave off a lot of the subplots and the other complications and a lot of the world building and just cut to the core to write a short story. That's what it takes. But you need an interesting idea and an interesting character to drive it with an interesting conflict and an interesting goal. That's pretty much the same as a novel. It's just on a smaller scale, really.
How helpful is short story writing towards getting a book deal or getting into publishing?
Well, in science fiction, at least, there's a lot of short fiction markets. So selling short stories is a great entry point to build up your reputation, build up your name, get people to know, you know, that respect your writing. And, you know, you can win contests or the Hugo or the Nebula or Writers of the Future, for example, and you'll get a lot of attention from agents and publishers who say, we want to see something long form from you. And you can even get, you know, a potential book deal down the line out of that. So short stories play an important role in science fiction, at least. I think the only other market that I can think of where short stories probably play a big role is probably maybe Mystery, because there's a few big mystery magazines, and maybe some degree in literary. I don't think that they don't play near as big of a role in romance and some of the other genres as they do in science fiction. So it's a huge entry point for our genre fiction.
That's the thing that I read short stories when I was a kid, and like picking up, I think it was Asimov's Mysteries, you know, and Asimov's short stories sort of, I think, resonated more for me than perhaps some of his novels. And you know, getting into that, I think I loved the pithiness. I love that of Arthur C. Clarke, but that's sort of it's interesting when you say that there's like a market for that, because I think if you're slightly outside of sci-fi, you're not really aware of that, of where those things go to live.
Well, I think if you're out of sci-fi, the other difference is we've got markets that pay professional rates. You can get, you know, 8 to 10 cents a word, 6 to 10 cents a word for your story. And there's a lot of, like, literary markets, a lot of them don't even pay, or what they pay is a token. So I think we're lucky. We have a market where we can actually get paid to do short fiction. And, you know, it's tougher. I mean, there are a few things like New Yorker and, okay, I don't know if they do it anymore. Playboy used to buy a lot of fiction and they paid really good rates. A lot of things like that. There are a few exclusive things here and there that pay really well for fiction. There's a lot of children's magazines that pay really well for fiction. But if you're not writing children's or you're not writing science fiction, there's not a lot of places to go. So I think that if you're not aware of those genres, you wouldn't know. I mean, I have friends all the time that come up to me, where do I sell this story? And I can easily name 12 to 15 markets in science fiction and fantasy for them. If I try to do something else, I'm kind of like a little bit lost. I don't know what else to name for them.
Well, I mean, that's a great starting point. I would recommend people check out your website. If you go to, we'll put that up on the page in the link, but it's brianthomasschmidt.net. Do you have is that the easiest way to find you?
Yeah, you can find me there. You can go to my Facebook author, Brian Thomas Schmidt author editor page, which is basically Facebook/ Brian Thomas S. There's two S's, right?
So just Thomas with two S's?
Yeah. I mean, you can find me on Facebook there. Yeah, there I am with my little lightsaber. You can find I really need to update that. Boy, that's an old profile thing. All right. Anyway, let's deal with that later. Sidetrack. You can find me on Twitter as Brian Thomas S. I'm not as active on Twitter in my Brian Thomas S handle as I used to be. I really focus more on Facebook and I focus more on my author site. I'm not that hard to find. A lot of people find me, so I don't think you can find me.
Brian, I got to ask you something here, because I'm looking at your website and I'm scrolling down to all the amazing work that you've done, and considering, you know, some of the fun-loving attitude we have on this show, I couldn't help but have my eye caught by 102 more hilarious dinosaur jokes for kids, as written by Brian Thomas Schmidt. Can you tell us a dinosaur joke?
Oh my god, dude! I'd have to actually go. You know what? I will tell you a joke, but I'm gonna have to get up. grab the book, because I wrote this thing like 4 years ago. Kids ask me that all the time, and I have to go look it up because I don't remember the jokes.
That's amazing.
Hey, listen, this is what like, journalism's all about. We're really getting into the really important elements of this story. Sure,
for the last 20 minutes, you Brian Thomas Schmidt himself go somewhere and get something.
While he does that, I'm going to suggest to everybody, by all means, check out his page, check out his books. If you go to Amazon, you can see The Worker Prince, the first one in the book series that he's got there. If you get the Humble Bundle, you can obviously read a selection of stuff that he's assembled there and get that. He is a Hugo-nominated editor, by the way. Okay, so this is a guy that obviously has some taste on things, and he's been a best science fiction release from BarnesandNoble.com. So Brian is a very interesting guy, somebody worth, you know, following and paying attention to what he's doing, because he's one of these people that I meet that has a really good sense of what's going on in the industry overall, of who people, you know, what people are doing. This is a guy who was one of the first people to take a look at The Martian and edit Martian, you know, and that turned out really well.
Yeah.
Yeah, it did, didn't it? All right. Remember, these are kids' jokes, and you asked for it.
Okay? All right, dude. I'm ready. I'm in.
What do you call a dinosaur who won't take a bath?
A dirty sore?
A Stegosaurus.
Stegosaurus.
What happens when dinosaurs dance?
What?
An earthquake. There you go. Kids love these. The parents, I don't think, love them near as much because they hear them over and over and over.
No, listen, I'm going to call somebody a Stinkosaurus just on the streets.
Yeah, exactly, man. Hey, you Stinkosaurus.
You Stinkosaurus.
If you want a co-writer for another book of those jokes, talk to Justin. He can.
Absolutely. I'm all about it.
The Uncle Justin now.
Oh yeah, no. Yes, I'm gonna need to bone up on it. You know, I gotta. My
there
brother
you go. You'll have somebody kids, to read so. Those to very soon. And there's cute little dinosaur pictures inside too. I have to like this guy on the front cover's kind of, you know.
Yeah, no, he's a very hip looking alternative comic dinosaur. Oh,
that is what you call it, a singing dinosaur, a raptor.
A raptor.
That's the raptor. That's
amazing.
Amazing.
Art, we want to do after things picks?
Let's do picks.
I already got mine. It's 102 more dinosaur jokes.
Yeah, there is actually 101 hilarious dinosaur jokes book. So the reason it's 102 more hilarious dinosaur jokes is because the publisher hired me to do a sequel. I'm moving away from the window where all this light is so you can see me better. So excuse me while I carry... And walk with my laptop here.
Yeah, as far as picks, though, I mean, the closest thing I have, I mentioned it in the main show, is Bold by Peter Diamandis. I think I mentioned it a few times, but still really well good and relevant to stuff we discussed.
I'm going to go with my pick's going to be The Worker Prince by our guest here, Brian Thomas Schmidt. Go check that out. You can order it either from wordfirepress.com or Amazon. And, Brian is Brian. You're a neat guy. You're a very interesting guy, and I look forward to actually reading your stuff here. And this sounds very, very interesting. This is a book that captures the original feel of Star Wars. It's Moses meets Star Wars. I mean, that's done.
It's fun. It's fun. Hey, look! Don't forget to talk about the Humble Bundle. Go out and buy the Humble Bundle, guys. Yeah, I'm sure they'll put the link up for you. But you know, you can pay what you want, and you can get these fantastic books. And it lasts another 10 days or so. But you know, it's a bunch of ebook reading. You can't beat the bargain, and you're helping charity. There's two very worthy charities, including the Challenger Center and the CIFWA Medical Fund, that you're helping by your donation. So a portion of proceeds will go to both of those.
Absolutely.
My pick is going to be Zootopia. I saw it yesterday. I very much enjoyed it. I think it is a great sign of Disney animation being in one of its many boom periods. But more specifically, I want to direct people who dug that movie, which is quite a few, to the Fusion documentary, Imagining Zootopia, uploaded by Fusion to their YouTube account. That shows some really big behind the scenes tracking of how the movie got made. You know, their research trips to Africa to get their character designs down, and a lot of the very famous Pixar inspired story breaking down that found them, you know, making really 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 hard decisions at really pivotal points with the movie that wound up having them spend a lot more money to change the direction of it and tame it down to make it lighter where it needed to be lighter but while still retaining some of the really awesome cogent fantasy sci-fi inspired sort of allegories to real life problems. So I very
well,
much
I my enjoyed, job. I want to go do that job. I mean, geez, that sounds awesome.
Absolutely. Yeah. Imagining Zootopia is the doc.
Brian, thank you for joining us. Justin, other Brian, it's been after.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.